Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today...
Well, it's stories about confrontation...
Throwdowns.
Face-offs.
Smackdowns.
We're calling it, What's Left When You're Right.
And now, at last, that title will make sense.
I think it will, because now we have a story about a fight that starts in a cage, spills over into the human species as a whole, and turns out in the end to be nested inside the brains of every single one of us.
Ooh.
And that story comes from our producer, Pat Walters.
It all started for me with this essay that I read by this guy named Jonathan Gottschall.
I'm a writer.
And a fighter.
And a bad, bad man. So a few years ago, I'm an English teacher. I'm sitting in the English department. I'm sitting in the cubicle.
He was a teacher at a small college outside Pittsburgh. And at the time, Jonathan had written some articles, even a couple of books.
But I was still an adjunct, a lowly adjunct, you know, the academic equivalent of cheap migrant labor.
Pretty low on the totem pole.
So I was sitting there in the cubicle that I share with other adjuncts, just kind of feeling miserable, down about my job. And then I catch a glimpse of movement through the window. And I go to the window and I look out.
And notices that across the street where there used to be a car parts store,
this new business had opened up, a mixed martial arts gym. This cage fighting stuff that you see on TV.
The kind where you can, where anything goes, like that kind? Or
anything goes, yeah. Punching, kicking, kneeing, ground and pound. You can climb on top of a guy and punch him in the face until he goes out.
That stuff is just too raw.
Well, I had been watching it guiltily and very much in the closet for about 15 years. I knew it was wrong. I watched it in the way that most men watch porn. You know, my wife would walk into the room and I was watching. I really quickly turned the channel.
But now there they were, these huge, muscle-bound dudes in the picture window right across the street.
They're in the cage. They're hitting each other. They're tackling. They're fighting on the ground.
And as he watches them day after day,
I start to envy them. I envy their bravery and the way they just seemed so alive while I was in my cube rotting.
And so one day he decides...
I decide to do it.
I'm going over there.
No, I'm not a tough guy. I'm an English professor. I'd never been in a fight before. But I wanted to try to do a brave thing.
Did you tell your wife?
Yeah, yeah.
What was your wife's reaction?
This is almost a perfect paraphrase. She said, "You will be killed. You have no skills." Yeah, it kind of hurt. It hurts to find out your wife has no respect for your fighting prowess.
But that doesn't stop him.
No.
He starts training, sparring with other beginners.
And this is how it all goes down. Maybe I'm 4 months into my training. Let's say I'm about 4 months into my training. And I feel like I'm starting to get the hang of things. I'm starting to feel more confident. And I'm doing pretty well against the other beginners and the sort of the weaker guys in the gym. So one day I go into the gym and it turns out I'm gonna spar this guy named Nick. And I'm a little concerned about it because he's been at the gym longer than me. But I'm not all that concerned because I've watched Nick. We all watch each other in the gym. And he's just not an athlete. He even says this himself. He's kind of a klutzy guy. He's awkward in his movements a little bit stiff. And I felt that just like athletically, I stacked up very well with him. I was faster than him. I thought I'd get around better. And so, you know, we go into the cage and the bell rings and, you know, we go to the center of the cage and we engage. And again, I'm feeling confident.
And then?
He punches me hard in the face.
Then he hits him again.
The punches keep coming. Jab, cross, jab, cross, jab, cross, jab, cross, hook. He doesn't bob, he doesn't weave, he doesn't dance. He's right there in front of you. You should be able to hit him, but I can't. He's just hammering me.
Finally, the bell rings.
And I go collapse in one of the chairs, and my headache is already thudding in my brain. And I say to myself, well, that seals it. The Forey-Raymond hypothesis has to be true.
The Forey-Raymond hypothesis has to be
Forey.
Oh, the Forey-Raymond.
Yeah.
So, okay. What's the right question?
What is the Forey-Raymond hypothesis?
Okay, so Forey and Raymond are these French researchers.
Okay, so before we get down to the two French researchers, you should say that Nick, that guy Jonathan fought.
Nick is a lefty.
Jonathan is a righty.
Mm-hmm.
And this conflict between lefties and righties, it goes way back.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Just ask David Woolman.
I'm an author and journalist in Portland, Oregon.
You're right-handed, right?
No, I am very left-handed.
Said that like he wanted to kill me.
I was trying to get it out that way.
Like Batman defends, you know, against crime, David is a defender of lefties everywhere.
I am a strong left-hander. If you look at the Edinburgh Handedness Inventory, I'm like a 10 out of 10.
I did it. I'm a very strong right-hand. I'm like a, I got like a perfect score for right-handedness.
Okay, well, our friendship is over now.
David's kind of joking, but he actually wrote this whole book called A Left-Handed Turn Around the World, because
growing up as a kid in a family of right-handers,
David says he always felt a little different, or as his family used to put it,
you're special, and this is some little extra sprinkle of specialness in you. luckily, they're not, you know, they didn't grow up in the Middle Ages and think that I was cursed by the devil, and therefore I'm left-handed. Because throughout the ages and pretty much throughout every culture, left-handers were perceived as evil and sinister.
In fact, the word sinister itself is derived from a Latin word, which means on the left side. And in English, when we say something is correct, we say it's right.
You know, in the Bible, God is always doing really nice and benevolent things with the right hand and not so nice or benevolent things with the left hand. Everything left is always ugly or lesser or different or worrisome. And the presumption was that if this was not the result of a curse from the devil, then this was the result of poor parenting or poor posture.
But we know now that.
No.
It's genetic.
When you do a genetic study and you look at parents.
Here's how it plays out.
If you have two right-handed parents, their chance of having a left-hander is about 9.5%. If you have one righty, one lefty parent, the odds do go up.
Now you've got
20%, almost 20% chance. Then two southpaw parents have a 26% chance of delivering into the world a southpaw.
And if you add up those chances and look out across the entire human species,
we are about 90% right-handed, 10% left-handed.
90% of people are right-handers.
Which brings us back to Forey and Raymond.
So Forey and Raymond realized that left-handedness is a sort of evolutionary mystery.
Jonathan says it's a mystery, at least in part, because left-handedness seems to come with some disadvantages.
It's associated with all these negative health outcomes, and I actually wrote a few of them down. Higher risk of schizophrenia,
really?
Immune deficiency, epilepsy, learning disability, spinal deformity, ADHD, alcoholism, dyslexia, psychopathy, Crohn's disease. It's not even a complete list.
So wait, lefties have a higher incidence of all of these things?
Yeah, significantly.
How much higher? Like a teeny bit higher?
Teeny bit.
Like a really teeny bit.
But evolution works on teeny bits, right? So if there are significant health costs to being left-handed, why hasn't natural selection trimmed it away?
Why do we still have lefties at all? That's the puzzle. And the Forey and Raymond hypothesis is that we still have lefties in the world because they have an advantage in one arena.
Combat.
Which is what Jonathan realized in the ring with Nick.
You get very used to fighting right-handers. You get used to where the punches are coming from. And then you face a left-hander. And they do everything backwards. And you have to develop basically a whole different approach to fighting.
And if you go back to a time when wars were won and lost largely because of hand-to-hand combat,
whether with fists or with spears or with clubs or whatever,
maybe the ancient lefties, like Nick, had a little edge.
Maybe the survival advantage of battling left-handed washed out those survival costs associated with being left-handed.
So Forey and Raymond came up with this prediction.
A prediction based on their idea.
That if left-handedness is somehow linked to fighting prowess, then
wherever they go in the world, they will find that the most violent societies have the highest proportion of lefties.
How would they define violent? Like over time, the number of wars or what?
Numbers of wars, homicide rates, that kind of thing.
I see. Huh.
So they dug up some data on violence and left-handedness in three different tribal societies. Then they went out and did their own field research in five other groups.
And they find this beautiful correlation. The least violent society in their sample had 3% left-handers. The most violent societies in their sample, tribal societies in New Guinea that were notoriously violent, had rates of left-handedness at about 25 or 30%.
Whoa. Whoa.
It was this
three
incredible...
times as many lefties as us, I guess?
Yeah.
Wow.
So it seemed to be true.
Case closed. No.
No.
Here's the thing. That tribe from Papua New Guinea that had three times as many lefties as you would expect, that was data that they looked up in the library. But when some other scientists actually went in the field and checked it,
they found no evidence that lefties were overrepresented in this tribe.
It wasn't heavily lefty.
According to this study, they just didn't find any evidence that lefties were overrepresented.
I am disappointed because this was a very cool idea.
I was disappointed too. But I think we can salvage it. The original...
Here's where Jonathan had an idea of his own. After Nick knocked him out, he thought, maybe looking at real battles, real violence, maybe that was where Fowry and Raymond went wrong.
Maybe lefty genes are maintained more through success in the play fights of sports than in actual no-holds-barred violence.
Maybe it's about sports, not war.
In fact, actually, lefties have long been known for doing better at all kinds of different sports, tennis, boxing, baseball. We looked at a Northwestern study, Jed, which found that 50% of the top players in baseball at its highest RBIs, the best pitchers.
Wait, 50% are lefties?
Yes. And you see this same overrepresentation of lefties in any sport that's got a one-on-one component, you know, a face-off kind of thing. The only scientific question you need to ask is,
do athletes have more children?
Oh, wait a second. So you're saying all those lefty pitchers that are really good and that screw up the right-handed hitters, maybe they're having so many kids.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps that 10% 10%?
Well, sort of. Yeah. So, but
we can check this. We can have Lefty Gomez, New York Giant left-hander, has 16 children.
Kids.
Yeah.
So people have actually looked into this. You know, they've looked into it. Do athletes do better with the ladies? And the evidence is pretty strong that they do.
Really?
Anybody who went to high school,
do athletes
you went to high school and college.
Well, yeah, that seems
this?
Like, duh, you don't need a scientist to tell you that.
And
like,
so,
but you have to count the babies,
exactly.
Count the babies. Are they counting the babies?
Or you count the reproductive opportunities.
Which you mean like how many dates they go on?
Yeah, exactly. How many sex partners they have.
Why not count the babies? You don't want to count the babies?
Well, because we live in an era of birth control now. And so it's in the environments in which these traits evolved, there were no reliable means of birth control. So we use reproductive opportunities as a proxy for reproductive success.
And then, okay, it's starting to make sense to me now.
How could I lovingly say that sounds like total garbage?
You'd think David would love this idea. He's the lover of lefties, but no.
It's just, there's too much biology at play here. And too much ancient, prehistoric biology at play for this to matter as much as your dear English professor friend wants it to matter.
But here's the thing. Whether or not this has been proven scientifically, personally, I know it's true. You know, I know it's true because I experienced it. I know it's true in a way that statistics can't touch. You know, I know it's true from being in that cage, having the undoubtable truth just pounded into my brain, literally, by my friend Nick. You know, I know it's true. Yeah.
I mean, it's so fun. These kind of things are so fun because it's so easy, right? I mean, who doesn't love an easy answer? But it seems so far-fetched, and maybe that makes me a little bit of a wet blanket. But after this year plus investigating this topic...
David says about halfway through writing his book, this whole handedness puzzle kind of flipped for him. Instead of worrying about why lefties have stuck around, he started to wonder about that 90-10 number. Like, why in humans do lefties only make up 10% of the population when in pretty much every other creature on Earth?
This asymmetry is random. In other words, it's a coin flip whether a monkey in South America is going to be left or right-handed.
Several studies have shown that it's about 50-50 in cats. Same is true for dogs. People have looked at mice, toads, various kinds of birds, and all of them have a pretty even split.
It looks like what is unique to humanity is the 90-10.
So how did we end up at 90-10?
Well, one of the strongest theories for the origins of handedness hooks handedness onto left hemisphere dominance for speech.
The idea, says David, is that humans are way back in the day, so these would be like early humans, pre-human ancestors, were 50-50s. That is, they were 50% righty, they were 50% lefty, like all the other animals in the forest. So the things that our brains were doing back then were also even on both sides. So the motor cortex on the left controlled the right hand, as it still does. The motor control on the right controls the left hand, as it still does. But then,
at some point in our evolutionary history,
language begins to develop.
And there was this shift in brain organization.
The part of the brain that controlled speech, I don't know why this happened, but it began to move over to the left side of our brain. According to one theory, that shift ended up making the left side of our brains better at motor control. Because think about what speech is. I'm going to say, let's pick a pair of pickled peppers. Mm-hmm. My tongue, my lips, my teeth are all in a medley of complex motion there.
And
that is all about motor control. So the left side of my brain is doing that, and it's getting bigger and stronger. As the species gets more and more speechy, it gets more and more left-brained or right-handed.
So you're saying that as speech grows on our left side, the motor cortex grows on our left side. And since the left motor cortex controls the right hand, the end result is a bias to the right.
Yes.
But weirdly, buried somewhere deep in our DNA, still
is this gene that confers the chance to become left-handed.
Which results in about 10% of the population being lefties.
But they're not dwindling, though. They just seem to stick there.
Well, they don't seem to be dwindling in the blink of an eye. That is
we're not,
the time we've been looking
at this.
We're
not dwindling.
But you know what I mean?
Shut up, lefty.
Or whatever. Maybe there's just, you know, you're just still around because you're like a vestige of what we used to be.
Thank you. I'll call my, as soon as my kids are old enough to, I'll tell them that daddy's a vestige.
Which sort of brought us back to our original question. Like, why aren't lefties dwindling? And when we pushed David, here's what he finally said.
I would argue because I'm a lefty and a strong left-hander, so, you know, take many, many grains of salt. Right.
You're arguing from pride. We understand
of
that.
Of course. No, pride and a little bit of research, but I would argue that a splash of diversity within the brain as far as brain organization has had a cumulative beneficial effect for our species. Now, if you
how exactly does he mean?
Well, because if conditions on Earth should change radically, nature just likes to have a little variety in the gene pool. So if everyone's doing really well with one set of genes and the situation changes drastically, you don't want everybody to get sick and die. So in variety, there is a slightly heightened chance of survival.
I think it's a subtle advantage to the population, but I think there's a beauty to it nevertheless. Lefties are coming at the world from a slightly different angle.
But this puts David in kind of a weird spot. Because even if lefties don't dwindle away, if sports or brain diversity or some other random reason keeps them around, they'll always be the few.
You know, as I said in the book, I don't think this is cause for the next March on Washington. But lefties are their own special minority group.
Unless you are a parrot.
This is Coco. He was
yes. Somehow I knew you guys would go for the parrot.
As it turns out,
parrots seem to be, I think it's 90% left-handed or left-footed or left-clawed, left-taloned, whatever I'm supposed to call it.
Robert and I went to visit this artist named Hunt Slonim, who rescues a lot of parrots.
This is a cockatiel whose name is Crayola.
And we tested 11 of his birds.
So they told us that the test that they've used before is you put a piece of food on the table or on a platform, and whichever foot they pick it up with is their preferred foot.
Well, that makes sense.
We would walk up to a cage.
This is Clive.
Ah! Hi.
Greet the parrot.
I'm going to give you a potato chip.
Present it with our treat, and then we would wait to see what it did.
A lefty. We have a lefty.
We went up to another cage, did the same thing.
A left foot.
Another lefty.
And in the end, oh.
Left again.
The final count was.
Okay, well, so our final tally was what, 9 to
2 to 1.
9 lefty, 2 righty, and 1 went both ways.
No, so that is close to 90%.
Close to, yes.
So if David was a parrot, he would have felt right at home.
But why do you suppose parrots are 90 to 10 the other way?
I have no idea. I don't think anybody knows.
Rosetta. Here, Rosetta.
On the other hand, hi. They do talk a lot.
Perfect. That's funny. Hi. What is this singing?
We've incited mayhem.
Oh, this is nothing. They're in their best behavior.
Before we close, we have a little sad news. Our producer, Pat Walters, Parrot Walters, we'll be moving on, moving to the left coast after this show.
If you listen to this show over the last few years, you've heard all kinds of wonderfully strange and diverse tales that have taken Pat to all kinds of different places and put him in all kinds of different moods. And you hate to lose a rainbow, you know, and he is one, so.
Definitely, definitely. Pat, we love you. We wish you the very, very best out there.
Hello, this is Sue.
Jonathan Gottschall.
Hello, this is David Woolman.
Giving you guys the credits.
Here we go.
Video Lab is produced by Jad Boomrod.
Our staff includes
Ellen Horn,
Thorne Wheeler,
Pat Walters,
Kim Powers,
Brenna Farrell,
Molly Webster,
Melissa O'Donnell,
Dylan Keefe, Jamie York, Lynn Levy, Andy Mills, and Kelsey Padgett.
With help from Ariane Wack, Simon Adler,
and Chris Nell.
Special thanks
to Sam Bryant
and TJ Voigt.
TJ Vogt. Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
End of message.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.